The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society. The Korea Society, in 2007, celebrating 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org.
On December 20th, 2007, 24 hours after Im Young-bak won the presidential election in South Korea, Donald P. Gregg and Evans J.R. Revere, the chairman and president of the Korea Society, Don Zagoria, project director of the Northeast Asia Projects at the National Committee on American Foreign Policy, and Leon Segal, director of the Northeast Asia's Cooperative Security Project at the Social Science Research Council, analyzed the election and its consequences at an informal panel discussion.
Gentlemen, good afternoon. I'm Evans Revere, the president of the Korea Society. Thank you very, very much for coming here this afternoon. I hope you've had a chance to grab a bite to eat. If you have not, please feel free. It's the holiday season. You're allowed to indulge. We have dessert, coffee, etc. back there after your sandwiches. We don't mind if you eat while we talk. It's a delight to have you all here. Every 5 years, those of us who watch developments on the Korean Peninsula around this time of year take a break from our Christmas shopping and holiday partying to engage in election watching. And that's what we've all been doing for the last several days. And it's been a most interesting election indeed, a tremendous victory for the former mayor of Seoul. A very interesting margin of victory, which signifies something, and we'll talk about what that something may be during the course of this afternoon. And it's a most significant political development as well, because we've had, as a result of the vote of the Korean people, a change in government, a government that will take office in just a few weeks' time on the 24th of February. Led by a center-right party, the GNP, the Hanarodang, a conservative party, and a president who is very different from all previous Korean presidents in an interesting way, former mayor of Seoul, obviously, but also a man who was a businessman, a career businessman, has a very interesting background. What this election portends, what this new leadership portends, what this political shift portends for Korea, for the Korean Peninsula, and for U.S.-Korea relations is the subject of our discussions today. I must tell you, if you were listening carefully for the last 10 minutes or so, there was a lively conversation going on down at this end of the room. It was not just about the recent Korean election, it was about the upcoming U.S. election. And as tempting as it is for us to engage on that subject along the lines of our lively discussion a few minutes ago, I think we'll stick to the subject that we brought you all here for. What I would like to do is just briefly introduce the gentleman on our panel here today. But looking around the room at all of you, I realize that virtually everybody in this room knows who they are already. You have biographical material there, but we are really honored and delighted to have to have the A-team up here in the podium with me today, people who have tremendous experience on the Korean Peninsula, in Asia, dealing with all the issues that we're going to be talking about today. And I could not think of a better group of people to pull together on this this fine Thursday afternoon to chat about what has just happened in the Republic of Korea as a result of this vote. To my immediate left, of course, is Chairman Don Gregg, the chairman of the board of the Korea Society, who is known to all of you here, former ambassador to the Republic of Korea, former NSC staff, former career CIA officer, lots of formers, but worked for Bush 41 as his national security advisor when the former President Bush was vice president. He has a wealth of experience in Asia and on the Korean Peninsula in particular, and we are absolutely delighted to have him here with us today. And, of course, to his left, a familiar face to all of you as well, Professor Don Zagoria. I'm trying to think of an issue that he's not an expert on. Don is down at the other end. They switched seats on me here. an expert on proliferation matters, U.S.-Russia, U.S.-Soviet relations, cross-straits issues, Taiwan, China, you name the topic. He, in his current capacity...
He's spread too thin.
Well, he's saying he's spread too thin, but I don't know about that. And he's a person who is eminently qualified to talk about the various subjects that we're going to talk about today. And, of course, to Don Gregg's left is Lee Siegel, one of the premier experts on North-South relations, on proliferation matters as they relate to the Korean Peninsula. Lee goes way back on this issue in particular, on the six-party talks and the four-party talks and US-DPRK bilateral discussions. On the overall North-South dynamic. And so we've really got a great and high-powered team here to chat about these issues today. I thought what I would do is maybe just ask Ambassador Gregg to open up with just a few thoughts and comments about the president-elect who has been here to the Korea Society, has been here to New York several times. A number of you probably have had an opportunity to meet him and listen to him. And to try to put the man in the context of the times and talk a little bit about the president-elect and about the Korean presidency and what this election may mean in a broad sense. And then we'll segue from there to a number of other related issues. Ambassador Gregg.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for coming. And it's a very interesting sort of mood that I sense about this election. I was comparing it in my mind to the last three inaugurations, all of which I attended. Kim Il-sung's election was, I would say, sort of less than triumphal. It was sort of a battle between among the three Kims, and Kim Il-sung won. Then Kim Dae-jung's election, I think there was more sort of anticipation as to what he would do, having been through all that he had been through. Noh Moo-hyun's election was a surprise. I went to bed thinking that Lee Hae-chan was going to be elected and woke up and here was Noh Moo-hyun. But this election really has not come as a surprise because I think that Lee Myung-bak was recognized as soon as he got I think his real struggle was in winning the party's nomination against Park Geun-hye. I think that's probably the most difficult test that he will have to deal with. Now, Korea is very hard on its presidents. I cannot think of a Korean president who has not either been carried out of office in a box or gone to jail or has left with family disgraces sort of blurring his exit. And there, we may have a reversal of the pattern here, because you have a man coming into office with something of a question about him. And I feel quite confident in saying that he will not limp out of office. I think he will gallop out of office, having accomplished a lot. And I say that because the man's record is really quite astonishing. When I arrived in Seoul in 1973 as chief of station for CIA, whenever I went to Gimpo Airport, it was full of weeping Korean women saying goodbye to their husbands who were going off to build airports or buildings or what have you in the Middle East. And then we heard of how well those buildings were constructed and how in some cases the Koreans worked all night and slept all day and got twice as much done. And the man who was president of all of that was Lee Myung-bak. He became CEO of Hyundai Construction at the age of 36, a man who collected garbage to put himself through Korea University. An extraordinary rise, just an extraordinary rise. I have met him several times, and I first met him during sessions of the Seoul International Business Advisory Council. And I remember when he showed up, and he first told us of his plan to do Cheonggyecheon. Is that how you pronounce it? Which is just, thank you, which is, I think, just had a tremendous impact upon the city of Seoul. And I remember as we all sort of rolled our eyes and looked at each other and said, you know, is this possible? Well, it has been done, and it has been beautifully done. He also is a man of real independence. When Chung Ju-young, the founding giant of Hyundai, made an ill-advised run for president in 1992, Lee Myung-bak did not support him. He left him, and which is very, very unusual for a Korean to do. And so each time I have met him, I have been very, very impressed. And one of the things that he said this morning impressed me, and Evans reminded me of it, and that somebody was saying to him, well, thank God this 10-year era of liberalism is over. And Lee Myung-bak said, hey, I don't discredit everything that's been done in the past 10 years. And I think that's exactly the right kind of thing to say. He's energetic. He's very dynamic. I think that the fact that the Bush administration has turned toward the center in terms of North Korea, and that Lee is a little bit to the right of center, I think they will get on extremely well. I think the North Koreans probably are a little bit nervous, wondering how different Lee Myung-bak will be, but we'll have good things to be said about that from Lee Siegel. But my vibrations on this election are just extremely positive. And I like what he's said. We've had letters from older Koreans, people of my age, who are just rejoicing because they feel that they now have somebody that they can relate to. So I'd say it's a very interesting time, and I just wish that our election were a little nearer than it is. and I hope we do as well as Korea when our time comes. So let me stop there. Right.
Well, with that great straight line, which I'm not going to pick up on, we'll move on. Thank you very much for that, Todd. Your comment about the surprise at the outcome of the previous election reminds me of a conversation that took place in a certain room in the U.S. Embassy 5 years ago, almost exactly today, in which a very senior U.S. official came to the embassy. He was visiting Korea at the time. I won't mention his name, but let's just say his chest is probably bigger than the chest of all four of us combined.
And he has no neck.
And he asked the collected group that was in the room who was going to win the election in a couple of weeks. And we went around the table, and Tom Hubbard was the ambassador at the time, and I was his deputy. And we went around the table, and the consensus view up until the point that they got to me and Tom Hubbard was that, of course, the GNP candidate was going to win. And then he turned to us and said, well, who's going to win this election? And both Tom Hubbard and I said, Nomu Hyun's going to win this election. And the shocked looks around the table were a clear indication that there was not a lot of understanding about the tremendous shift in the political dynamic that had taken place back in 2001, 2002, and the extent to which it was going to really change politics in Korea, and the extent to which it did change politics in Korea and resulted in the election of Nomu Hyun last time. Speaking of that, I wanted Lee Siegel to talk for a few minutes about the political dynamics here and what it is that we may have just witnessed as a result of this vote in terms of Korea's domestic politics, in terms of ideological shifts, in terms of shifts in political alignment, and to try to put the vote that's just taken place, the election that's just taken place, in a broader context of Korean political dynamics that we've been witnessing for the last 10 or 15 years. Over to you.
Well, let me begin by posing the question, what sort of North Korea policy do we want South Korea to pursue? And it seems to me, first, we wanted to pursue a peace process on the Korean Peninsula in ways that provide inducements for further denuclearization by Pyongyang. And secondly, we want the South to deepen economic engagement. Kim Jong-il kind of revealed his priorities for economic engagement in the summit meeting. And that provides what he revealed, in effect, provides everyone else with inducements for greater cooperation by Pyongyang in nuclear disarming. And this is what he wants. Okay, you get it as you proceed. But it seems to me most, but not all, of the projects should be conditioned on reciprocal action by the North. The reason I say most and not all is that we have to remember that engagement is the only way to bring about much-needed peaceful change in North Korea. And it's also ultimately the key to progress on human rights. And so you have to sustain an engagement strategy, keep momentum. Now, the other good reason for proceeding with some projects is to reassure the North that the inducements are not just like the carrot that's dangled out of the reach of the mule while it is being hit with a stick to get it to move. Remember, the mule doesn't ever get to eat the carrot. Okay? So we have to be careful here that the North knows they really are going to get something as they move forward, and therefore you want to sustain efforts. And the biggest thing is it hooks the North into cooperation with the South on projects it cares about. And getting the hook into North Korea is rather important here. We've got to deepen the engagement. But the real test here comes at the end of the game. If Washington and Tokyo, not just Seoul, move down the road to reconciliation with the North, and Pyongyang then refuses to give up its nuclear arms, the key question here is, will Seoul stop economic engagement? And it seems to me Lee Myung-bak is more likely than a center-left president to stop engagement if North Korea balks. And I think from the standpoint of a U.S. perspective on North-South, that's the significance of what's just happened. Now, the basic question in dealing with North-South matters in Seoul is Lee Myung-bak an ideologue or a pragmatist? Back in March of 2007, when he spoke to a small group of us, he sounded very much like an ideologue. He spoke of unification, implying the collapse of North Korea, and never once used the word reconciliation. Never once. Not in answers to questions, not in his formal presentation, never used the word reconciliation. In contrast to Park Geun-hye, who'd come through just before him, and had called for a special envoy, a U.S. special envoy, to go to Pyongyang and negotiate the nuclear issue in earnest, which was much more far-reaching. On the, you know, and these hardline views prompted one old Korea hand in the room to ask whether he could get elected on that platform, which was a telling question, because if you look at the way he ran this election campaign, back then, he was trying, when he came to the U.S., he was trying to, I think, ingratiate himself with Cheney and the hardliners in the Bush administration and Congress. But at the start of the election campaign in South Korea, he tacked to the left on North Korea. I mean, if you look at the GNP platform that he pushed for, it basically took the North Korea issue off the table in the election in South Korea. I mean, essentially, he embraced enough of the center-left views so that North Korea was never an issue in the campaign. He wanted to focus on economics, on the economy as the issue, and he succeeded by doing so. And if you read one of the nine planks there are nine planks in the basic platform. It says, work toward reconciliation with North Korea through a set of core principles, verification, reciprocity, mutuality, and reduction of weapons that threaten war. A commitment to Korean security must be part of a responsible approach to lasting reconciliation. In two short sentences, he used the word reconciliation twice. Remember, never using it when he came through here back when. So, and by the way, that platform provoked a real reaction on the right wing of the GNP, and anybody who reads Chosun Ilbo knows that, because there was a lot in that newspaper on it. So the question is, what will he do as president? Will he heed many of his top advisors on North Korea, some of whom I spoke to in my visit to Seoul just 2 weeks ago, who are quite ideological in their view of the North. Will he read the election results like some of the ideologues do as a decisive shift to the right, or as some pragmatists around him do, as basically a drop in turnout among the center-left who were totally disaffected from No, they felt he sold them out. And they were turned off by Chung as well. They thought he wasn't much better. And so they stayed home. Basically, you had an enormous drop in turnout, all of it on the left. On the right, there may have actually been a rise in the turnout because you had two center-right candidates, both of them distinguished. Okay, and so when you read the election returns, you've got to look at turnout. That accounts for most of the margin. There were some people who clearly switched sides, but that's not the fundamental thing that happened here. So will he take the usual post-election stance of reacting to his predecessor and taking anything but No stance on North Korea? Or will he adapt to Bush's more accommodating policy toward the North? Another way of framing the question is, what form of alliance politics would take precedence? Is it going to be the US-ROK alliance and therefore adjusting to the prevailing trend in relations with Washington and how Washington is viewing North-South? Or will it be the alliance of American and South Korean right-wingers against center-left? There are two alliances working here, okay? And we've got to be aware that second alliance, there are a lot of people in Seoul who were very friendly with the hardliners in Washington. And they were stunned by Bush's turnaround. And the question is, are they going to try and push back and get Lee to push back successfully? My hunch is, in fact, he will fall in line with Bush policy at the start. If for no other reason, then it's the economy, stupid. You cannot afford a crisis with North Korea if you want to move the South Korean economy ahead. You can't have foreign capital flight in a crisis. You don't want trouble. And if the Bush administration is moving ahead with North Korea, Im Myung-bak is not going to push back. What he won't be is as proactive as No was in dealing with the North and in pushing the United States to try to negotiate with the North. That'll be a difference. And that may be important if the Democrats take charge of Washington one day, because it will reinforce their timidity. If the South isn't pushing the Democrats will get skittish, is my fear. I'll stop there.
Let me just say one thing to back up what you just said. I was in Seoul in early November, just at the time where Lee Hui-chan had decided to run. And the thing that had motivated him to run was the fact that he and his people felt that Lee Myung-bak wasn't hard-line enough toward North Korea. And there was just total confusion in Seoul at that point as to what this would mean and how it would sort out. And Lee Myung-bak got more than almost four times as many votes as Lee Hui-chan. And the difference between them, essentially, is how they're going to react toward North Korea. So I find that extremely reassuring, and I hope we've heard the last of Lee Hui-chan.
Thank you very much for that intervention, and thank you, Lee, for an excellent overview on that. One of the fascinating things about Im Myung-bak's position on North Korea, and I guess we'll talk about this a little bit more later on, is that if you look at the details of the North Korea package that he has discussed on the campaign trail, he's actually offering the North more than either of the current or the previous ROK administration has ever offered the North. There's an interesting condition attached to it, of course, denuclearization. But the overall package that's being dangled in front of the North is an ambitious and considerable one indeed. And interestingly enough, the condition, if you translate it into its simplest terms, is just do what you've already promised to do in the six-party talks, which theoretically ought to be an easy condition for the North to meet, but we'll talk some more about that. Speaking of the six-party talks, Don Zagoria has followed this very closely. I would like him, if he could, to please give us your thoughts on how the dynamic in the six-party talks may change as a result of this election and a possible new approach that might be adopted by the ROK, and how some of the other parties in the six-party talks may react to the outcome of this election.
Well, thank you very much, Evans. I wanted to talk very briefly both about the six-party talks and about the China factor. So that will give us more time for questions. If I'm brief, we have a very knowledgeable group in the audience. In fact, some of you in the audience should be up here on the platform. My major overall point is that, just to reiterate what I think Don Gregg and Lee Sigal have already said, it seems to me that the election of this new conservative government in the ROK by a wide margin is very likely to strengthen the U.S.-ROK alliance. I think that's, for me, that's the major point. That alliance, although it has been improving somewhat in recent years, it's also been rather shaky in recent years. And to the extent that this election will help improve that alliance, I think that's really good news, because a stronger U.S.-ROK alliance will be extremely beneficial to the two major problems that we both have in Northeast Asia. One is dealing with North Korea, and the other is dealing with China. And I think a stronger U.S.-ROK alliance will help deal with both issues. Now, let me start with North Korea. First of all, as has already been suggested, this election pretty much ensures that the ROK and the United States are going to be on the same page in dealing with North Korea. Now, we were getting closer to being on the same page once the Bush administration changed its policy a couple of years ago and moved towards engaging North Korea, which was what the South Koreans had been doing for some time. But now we will be able to move down that page in much closer partnership. That page consists of a desire on the part of Washington and Seoul for closer relations with North Korea. Could be a peace treaty, could be security guarantees, could be much greater economic assistance, provided North Korea completely and verifiably scraps its nuclear weapons program. So in Lee's words, there needs to be reciprocity. The idea of reciprocity is now going to be injected into the South Korean lexicon. Reciprocity for reconciliation. And the reciprocity will have to come in the form of scrapping the nuclear program. Now, Don Gregg mentioned the year left of the Bush administration. Ambassador Gregg mentioned it somewhat regretfully. If I heard him correctly, I think he would like to move up the election in the United States a year. My own view is, however, that the fact that the Bush administration still has a year left in office, while we have a new South Korean president, provides an opportunity. This is a year of great opportunity. Now, why do I think that? I think that because I think the North Koreans understand now something about American electoral politics. They almost had a deal with the Clinton administration in 2000. Evans can tell you a lot about that. He was part of it. And then suddenly there was a new president in the United States in 2001, and we had a different policy towards North Korea. The deal that the Clinton administration almost had with the North Koreans was no longer. Now, the North Koreans remember that, and they understand it. And in our Track 2 meetings with them for the past 6 years, we have been pounding that point home, that namely that the last year or so of the Bush administration may be the last best opportunity they have for making a deal with the United States, because, as many people have said, if the Democrats were doing what the Bush administration is now doing with North Korea, the hardline Republicans would move for impeachment. If Hillary Clinton was ignoring the Syrian connection and ignoring everything that the that has been going on for the past year or so, which the Bush administration has been doing in an effort to get an agreement, it would be impossible. So Bush is in a position to make a deal with the North Koreans, and the Democrats, if they come to power in 2009, it'll take them at least a year or so before they get their policy straight, and they will not, they will have to be more timid in approaching North Korea. So I think this year interregnum with 1 year left of Bush and a more centrist South Korean president is an ideal combination for dealing with North Korea. I think there's some chance that the North Koreans will understand that. Now, let me turn to China. I want to talk about China and the China issue in a little bit longer range strategic perspective, rather than the tactical question of how they are going to deal with a new ROK president. I think they'll deal pretty much the same with a new ROK president as they've been dealing with the old ROK president. I don't think there's going to be much of a change on that score. But let me talk about the larger issue. It seems to me that the larger issue is that the rise of China, along with the problem of Islamic fundamentalism, seems to me the two great strategic challenges that the United States and its allies will have to deal with in the coming 5, 10, maybe longer years. The challenge with China is to help shape a positive global role for China while hedging against other possibilities. And there are other possibilities. I won't go into them unless you press me, but there are more negative scenarios that one could imagine for a powerful China over the next 1 or 2 decades. Now, so far, so good, I would say. U.S.-China relations are on a cooperative, rather stable path. And I would give the Bush administration, I wouldn't give it high marks in a lot of areas. In fact, in most areas, I wouldn't give it very high marks. But on China and East Asia, I would give it pretty high marks. I think the Bush administration has got China right, it's got Taiwan right, it's finally got the North Korean problem right, and South Korean-China relations are going well, economically, culturally, and so on. So right now, both the United States and the ROK have a good relationship with China. We hope to keep it that way. Now, over the longer run, it seems to me that the United States strategy towards China will have to be embedded in a regional strategy. We're going to need to get our regional strategy right. And in order to get that regional strategy right, we have to understand what the region i.e. Northeast and Southeast Asia, want. Now, it seems to me what the region wants is to engage China, to integrate economically with China, but the region also wants to balance China. Just look at what's happening. The U.S. and Japan are strengthening, have been strengthening their alliance for a number of years now, and China is the 500-pound gorilla in the room, potentially, that against which they are strengthening their alliance. The United States and India are moving closer together. Both of them are moving closer together with the China factor in the back of their minds. Singapore, Indonesia, Vietnam. Singapore in 2005 signed a new strategic framework agreement which expands military access for the United States. Vietnam has expanded intelligence cooperation with the United States. Indonesia has reopened bilateral military ties with the United States. All three of those countries worked with Japan to invite India, Australia, and New Zealand into the new East Asian summit in order to balance China's power and influence. Now, this is also going to be in South Korea's interest to engage China while balancing China. And I think the ROK elections confirms that general direction. The South Koreans, it seemed, from my reading of public opinion polls in South Korea, are increasingly wary of Chinese influence, consider China a more significant long-range military threat than either Japan or even North Korea, and want closer ties with the United States. I think that's what public opinion polls suggest to me. So, in sum, I think the United States will now have, probably it won't be for this administration, but I think for the next American administration, there will be an opportunity to build stronger relationships within the region, with South Korea, with other countries in the region, so long as the United States recognizes that the region does not want to be forced to choose between the United States and China. That's a position nobody wants to be put into, and the United States shouldn't put the region in that position, nor should it put itself in that position. So we want both to engage China, to integrate China, while balancing China. That's going to be a tough assignment. I think one thing that we ought to work to that would facilitate that strategy is a new security architecture in Northeast Asia that would turn the present six-party talks into a regional security framework that would include China, as well as North Korea, as well as South Korea, Russia, Japan, United States, and so on. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Don, especially for putting all of this in a broader regional context. Your comments about the opportunity that's being presented here as a result of this election, but also as a result of the fact that we've got another year remaining in the U.S. administration, that's a very telling and important comment, and I agree with it completely. I think the turnabout in the Bush administration's policy really has opened the door for a lot of very good and very important progress to be made on the nuclear issue in the coming months. And it reminds me of where we were back in late 99 and 2000, when we also had a significant amount of time remaining in the previous administration. And in a coffee shop just a few blocks from here, I was sitting down chatting with my North Korean counterpart, trying to argue them out of taking what I described back then as an extended vacation from our bilateral talks, and warning them that they were misreading American politics and misreading the opportunity that was being presented to them back then. And indeed, that's exactly what happened. And a lot of progress that could have been made was not made because we basically ran out of time. And here we are again with a tremendous opportunity to make progress on these issues. And I hope that more wisdom will prevail than prevailed a few years back. I wanted to return to a theme that I introduced right at the outset, and that is looking at the domestic scene in the Republic of Korea, because it seems to me that if you look at Korean domestic politics over the last decade or so, one of the defining characteristics, I think, of this period, a period during which the party that has just won this election was basically wandering in the wilderness, but one of the defining characteristics of this period was a severe ideological split, if you will, in Korea between left and right. A lot of people have described it as the politics of rectification or the politics of retribution, in which a resurgent left has come to the fore, has captured the Blue House, has had a very dominant role directly and indirectly in Korean politics. And what was striking about this campaign is that that was not a dominant issue in the campaign. Neither was the North Korea issue that we've been talking about. Neither was the U.S.-ROK relationship that we've been talking about. The dominant issue appears to have been the economy. But the fact is, if you look at Korea for the last decade or so, it has been remarkable, this contention between left and right. What does this election say about that? Are the days of serious left-right split in South Korea over with? Have we entered a period of pause and reconciliation? Were people so concerned about the domestic economy that just overwhelmed all the other concerns that have been weighing on people's minds for the last decade or so? What just happened here in terms of popular attitudes and domestic politics?
I think it's very significant that Lee Myung-bak is the first businessman ever to be elected president of Korea. And I think that says a great deal about where Koreans think they are and who they have become. You had a long period where the three Kims were fighting for influence. You had Nomuhyun's election, which I think is still hard to explain. Before that, you had a very underrated president, No Tae-woo. If he had not been a general, I think he would have, what he achieved in his presidency would receive far more credit than it has, and it needs to receive more credit than it has, because it really established Korea as a neighbor. It got recognition from China, recognition from the former Soviet Union, and all of the Eastern European countries. I think he was an extremely effective president, and I think Lee is cut from the same cloth, and he can look back on his own personal rise and what he has accomplished as a businessman and as a mayor. And say the patterns that you saw me apply to the business world and to the governing of Seoul, I'm now going to apply to your government. And I think that's a very solid basis upon which he can move forward.
I think my starting point in talking about what's going on inside Korea is there's an astonishing stability to the democracy and kind of thriving democracy that doesn't exist anywhere else in the region except Taiwan, maybe. And you now have a passing of the torch, as you did rather starkly from Kim Yong-sam to DJ. Now you have it the other way. And there, nobody is suggesting that there's a question of, you know, is democracy going to survive? And this is done. And we really got to record the moment here. Something very important is going on. This is a dog that's not barking, and we got to notice that. That's number one. Number two, Korean politics, I'm afraid, is going to remain partisan. Why? Because a lot of people around Im Yong Bak are ideological partisans, both in the National Assembly, the folks from the National Assembly, some of whom will get cabinet positions, and some of the, you know, they've been 10 years in the wilderness, and they want to get back. I don't think it'll be as ideologically hidebound an administration, however. And I think that's important, that we're in a transition phase. The more significant thing is what's happened on the left, because the left has been demobilized by this election. The left was very disappointed by their candidate, Mel. And they were very unhappy, I think, with Trump. And they didn't vote. And the question is, what will the base of the center-left opposition do? Will it return to a more ideological front? Or are we witnessing a transition on the center-left? So just as one could argue the more right-wing of the GNP people didn't take over here, an important thing to watch is what happens to the left in opposition. Will it be ideologically strident, or will it go through a rethinking phase about domestic policy? And remember, underlying this is not the politics of the issue. The lower middle class in Korea, their economic circumstances have become much more precarious. If the world economy doesn't do well in the next 5 years, then there could be a real political crisis in Korea, because not enough people are getting into the middle class and staying there. Their situation is too precarious. And by the way, that's not dissimilar from what's going on in the United States either. So if you are worried that what's happened in the financial world spills over to the real economy in the world, not just in the United States, then you do have to be concerned as you look out. Korea needs to do a lot of things to get its economic policy right, but the practical reality is, no matter what a Korean president tries to do, Korea is at the mercy of larger economic forces that go beyond its borders. And if China continues to grow, that's one thing. If the world economy continues to grow, that's even better. But if things slow down, then you can have real political trouble, and we have to be alert to that.
But I think Korea has just elected the man best qualified to deal with all of the problems that you just outlined.
And I wasn't dissenting from that. The question is, can he?
Right, right. I mean, he would read the tea leaves very much as you are.
Right.
And the way to keep the left from rising up is to do some of the things he's already talking about, and that is getting the economy started, revising some of the inequalities between rich and poor. So,
I thought Don's point was exactly right. This is the first businessman to be elected as an ROK president. I was struck by his coining of, what is it, the 743?
747.
747. Yeah. He wants to turn,
you'll hear a lot about this in the coming
747.
Weeks.
He wants to turn Korea into the seventh largest economy in the world with a $4,000 per capita income. $40,000.
Beyond four.
And what's the third seven?
Growth rate.
The growth 7%. Rate of 7%. That sounds to me exactly the right priorities.
We've replaced the 386 generation with the 747 generation, is what you're saying?
Yeah. That's right.
Great comments here. I just wanted to note that if you read a lot of the comments that candidate Lee was making on the campaign trail, they really reflected his clear focus on precisely the points that Lee was making and this concern that a certain strata of the population of Korea was not was concerned about its future, its economic future, and that really was the centerpiece of his campaign in an important way. I want to turn to questions in a few minutes, but let me just throw one other issue out here on the table, and that is, as a couple of our panelists have already said, we did go through a rough patch in U.S.-ROK relations, perhaps the lowest point was about 2001 through 2003 for a number of reasons that are familiar to all of you, including differences over North Korea, base issues, the horrific accident that took the lives of these two young girls. But I think it would be fair to say, and I think my colleagues would agree with me, that the relationship is in a lot better shape today than it was 3, 4, 5 years or so ago. If you were advising the new Korean president on how to make sure that the current trend line in the U.S.-ROK relationship remains positive, if you were advising the Korean president-elect on how to get this relationship up to the next level, and if you were providing similar advice to the administration in Washington on how to reach out to the new Korean administration, what would be the one or two things on your short list?
Well, I think it's something that the Korea Society has already been talking about.
Glad you said that.
that is establishing some kind of a blue ribbon bilateral panel to just get distinguished Koreans and Americans together frequently to look at the whole spectrum of issues that our two countries are dealing with and come up with short reports that would go to the governments. We did this about 2 years ago here in this room, and we sent reports to the Korean government and to our government. I don't know whether anybody in our government read it, but the people in Korea read it and liked it. And so I think there ought to be more of that. I think somebody's mentioned a reformation of the wise men's group, and but that would be something that I would certainly consider. And I would also say just the people make such a difference. I mean, just the replacement of Rumsfeld by Bob Gates has made such a difference in terms of the military relationship. And so we ought to, we've also got a good opportunity in this last year to work on that.
I see Don Zagorian straining at the bit there.
I'd tell the new South Korean president to read the report that the National Committee on American Foreign Policy and the Korea Society just put out a few weeks ago on the state of the future of the U.S.-ROK alliance. Incidentally, for anybody in the room who would like a copy of that report, go online to I'll give you the email address. But in any case, the Korea Society, our national committee, and Hansung Ju's IPSICOR, the International Policy Studies Institute of South Korea, co-sponsored a conference here. We did it here, right?
That's right in
this
room.
We did it right in this room a month or so ago on how to strengthen the U.S.-ROK alliance. It's a 15 or 19 page report. I would like to think it provides a basis for the wise men when they are assembled. I commend it to you.
On our website, as a matter of fact, and if it's not, we'll get it up there today. But it's a good read. It's well worth it.
Let me just say two things. First of all, I'm not worried about the alliance now. I was very worried about it a few years back because I think the United States was getting both its North Korea policy and its regional policy wrong. But the important thing was it was getting its China policy right. And there, now the issue is, look, we can get the deterrence strategy. Deterrence is easy with North Korea. It is much harder to keep at the same pace with engagement, reconciliation with the North. And that's just a harder task to do. And now I think we're in better shape to do that. The second thing that is really important is I think all of us share Don Zagorian's understanding of what has to start to move. We have to evolve The United States has to evolve much more from a purely bilateral strategy in the region, or a unilateral, even worse, unilateralist strategy in the region, toward a more serious all-regional strategy. And the hard part for Korea is to take seriously its relationship with Japan. And that has to be on the table for Im Myung-bak. You have an opportunity in Japan because the competition is between Fukuda and Ozawa, both of whom want to move more regionally. They want to improve relations with China. They want to improve relations with both Koreas. Okay? And that's an opportunity for Korea. The problem is Korean politicians have wanted to play domestic politics with the Japan issue, and boy, I know why. You don't have to explain that to me. But you have to move beyond it. You have a real interest in seizing the opportunity you have in Tokyo to move ahead. So I would stress that, and that is important for the U.S. relationship as well. Because the U.S., it makes no sense for the usual model that the U.S. can somehow bring you and the Japanese together. Wrong. You, too, have to work it out with each other. We can't do that for you because there's too much bad history here.
Excellent point, with which I completely agree. I would put one additional thing on the short list. I've got my own list, but something that hasn't been mentioned here, and that is the importance of the free trade agreement. I think one of the most important additional things that can happen to enhance and expand the relationship between the U.S. and the ROK would be for the National Assembly and for the U.S. Congress to vote and pass the legislation putting that agreement into effect. And I think it would be just a tremendous boost to the bilateral relationship and partnership in the years to come. Let's open it up to questions. We look forward to hearing your questions. If you would, please do ask a question. We're the speech makers, but we'd like you to ask questions. Please identify yourself and your affiliation when you stand up. There are microphones that are going around. And the first hand that I saw up was way in the back over there. And if you could, if you want to ask your question to a particular individual, please do so.
No. That would be the question to anybody on this stellar panel to answer. Alexander Ilyich of the United Nations. I'm actually very pleased that the North Korean issue was not really an issue in this campaign. And my question will relate to this. Why I'm pleased? To me, after years of what all of us who were trying to do what we could that region, it was obvious that significant, serious change with regard to changing the dynamic regarding North Korea would be impossible until and unless South Korea finds and forges its own national consensus. What is it that that part of the Korean nation wants to do vis-a-vis the North? So to me, I would like to think that after years of this divide, whatever nuances and differences were there among the major candidates, I hope that this signifies one thing, that the country found its consensus, which is there is no alternative to engagement. Moreover, not simply engagement, we still should remember that several years ago there were terms like hostile engagement, other engagements. So to me, no alternative to constructive engagement. And if this is, and my question is whether the panel agrees with me. Because if this is the case, and we could see, by the way, that whatever differences were in discussing North Korea and the way it approaches, it was completely void of any ideological content. Nobody is afraid in South Korea of the system in the North, of the regime, its ideas. It's basically about what would be the best, most cost-effective way to deal in terms of this constructive engagement with the North, which is perfectly fine. To me, the importance of this is not only for the South, from the South Koreans. It's also important because we also wasted time was mentioned today, that we are running out of time or not. Well, I think this whole issues, they deserve longer-term approach, as they will do anyway without these elections or their other elections. But the question is, we saw the time was wasted. And because people, all the major players had to find their own sort of truth how to deal with this set of challenges. So if South Korea found at last this national consensus, it will have profound implications even for its most important allies and partners in region in this collective quest. So my question is the panel in agreement that one of the significant manifestations of this election is that probably, yes, South Korea is there? Thank you.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you, Alexander, and I'd like to take this opportunity to give you a quote from Kim Jong-il from a very close friend of mine who is an advisor to Hyundai Asan. And he has gone to North Korea frequently, and I'm not sure that he was in the room when this conversation was made, but Kim Jong-il was talking about Kaesong and what is happening in Kaesong. And he said, we fought very hard. We captured it from South Korea during the war. And we are now, in essence, giving it back. And we now have 15,000 men working there. I hope that we could have eventually 200,000 people working there. And if we did, I would be able to disband 10 divisions of my army. Now, that's a stunning quote. And it's Song Jong-nai, who is the senior advisor to Hyundai Asan, who passed that quote on to Bill Perry early this year. And so that's the kind of thing that it can now really come into focus. And a lot of friends, Korean friends my age, are still very suspicious of North Korea. But I think Lee Myung-bak represents the kind of person, because of his background, who can deal with those suspicions and really move forward.
I'm basically in agreement with you, Sasha. What I worry about is that there really are both people in the National Assembly and the GNP and people who are advisors to Lee who still have a kind of more ideological approach to the North that I think is potentially dangerous. And let me tell you where I think the issue is going to be. It will be about human rights, which is a real issue with North Korea. We all know that North Korea is an utterly unacceptable, you know, off the charts in human rights. The question really is how to get any significant improvement in the lives of ordinary North Koreans. And here, I think it's one thing to say, okay, we're as he just did, as president-elect yesterday, to say, you know, we're going to not be afraid of criticizing North Korea about this. Okay, but I'd be careful about how you do that. Because if you make your criterion for engagement be progress in human rights, I think you're going to be disappointed because the North will regard that as another form of regime change. I think you need to do engagement so that it actually does improve the lives of North Koreans, but not do it as this, you must change or you don't get something. And if you do it that way, it won't work. You know, there used to be an old saying in the Pentagon when I worked there, which was, if you want it real bad, you'll get it real bad.
Okay? Let's try to put that into Korean. John, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I agree with both what Alexander and Lee. And I think the good news is that I won't speak about South Korea, but I think the good news is that in the United States, we have moved in recent years towards a bipartisan consensus on how to deal with North Korea. Another meeting we had in this room that we helped sponsor along with the Korea Society, we had both Henry Kissinger and Madeleine Albright, and it was hard to tell the difference between the two on their approaches towards North Korea. in our meetings, we have congressional staff people who work both for Joe Biden and Richard Lugar. They're pretty much on the same page in dealing with North Korea. And it was very interesting. In our last meeting with the North Koreans, which was just quite recently, they no longer referred to the hostile attitude in the United States. That seemed to be off the table. And we had a rather business-like conversation with them. So I think there is a general recognition, leaving aside John Bolton and a few others, I think there's a general recognition in the United States that we don't really have a sensible alternative to dealing with North Korea other than what we're doing.
Next question in the back. I don't think the mic is on.
From Chinese mission to the UN. My question is, Li Minbo win this election because he has a strong commitment about economy. So the people becomes very pragmatic about economy. So in 3 months, Taiwan will also have presidential elections. So I want to ask the panelists, because you are all the Taiwan issue expert, in what extent the ROK election will have influence on the Taiwan election? Do you think the Taiwan people will care about the economy and less care about the Taiwan identity issue? This is my question. Thanks.
Pass on that.
I just got back from Taiwan a few days ago, and I'll comment on that. But let me ask Don Zagorin, who's up to his ears on this issue.
I've been involved in this issue for longer than I want to acknowledge, almost since the Treaty of Shimonoseki.
You were there at the table when they signed it.
Yeah,
right? The
Scalapino was there when they signed it. I'm not into the business of predicting elections, either American or Taiwanese. That's number one. But I will say this to cheer you up, Mr. Han. I think whoever is elected the next president of Taiwan, whether it's Ma Ying-jeou and the KMT or Frank She and the DPP, and I wouldn't rule out a She victory. It's the trends are now very close. But whoever wins that election will be a moderate, will be a pragmatist, will want to improve relations with the mainland and repair a troubled relationship with the United States. And we'll talk about regularizing flights, turning from charter flights to regular flights, regulating Chinese tourism to Taiwan, helping to improve investment. I think if Ma Ying-jeou, KMT win, they'll talk about a peace treaty, which is on Hu Jintao's agenda. I think there is a very encouraging constellation here. Hu Jintao's speech at the 17th Party Congress, when he referred to Taiwan, was very moderate. He did not even refer to the referendum issue. And so you have a moderate Chinese line on the cross-strait issue, and you have the prospect of a moderate next president of Taiwan, and we'll be through with the Chen Shui-bian era, which is probably just as well. And so I am rather hopeful about developments in Taiwan. And you're right; they've been emphasizing, both sides have been emphasizing the economy, as well as the Taiwan identity issue. In that sense, there is a similarity with the ROK.
Let me just offer a couple of thoughts. Taiwan was my very first diplomatic posting 100 years ago, and I just spent 6 days there and talked to everyone from intelligence officials to foreign ministry officials to my favorite people on the island, the taxi drivers. And what really struck me, and I'm glad you asked that question, Mr. An, because it really brought back to mind some of the comments that I heard from many, many people who were concerned about two things, And the two things were almost identical to things that I've been hearing on the streets of Seoul. Concerns about the economic future and a certain anxiety in Taiwan about the economic future of Taiwan that relates to a lot of issues, but it also relates to the political issues that Don referred to a moment ago. And the other issue was a frustration with political divisions and the left-right divisiveness, echoing things that I was hearing in Korea. Very, very interesting. I'm not going to predict the election. I'm not going to predict the outcome. I think Don has pretty much captured it. But what really struck me were those two themes that I heard in Taiwan were remarkably similar to the themes that I remember hearing in Taiwan during the course of my visit there last week. We had a question right here.
I'm Deputy Consul General, and I'd like to say a few words on possible future orientation of foreign policy of new administration. After the election, the president-elect made a statement where he made some references to foreign policy and North Korean policy. I think the new administration will be more pragmatic in pursuing foreign policy. And the president-elect basic foreign policy goal is to make Korea a global Korea, where Korea should be an active player on the international stage and be recognized by the world. In that respect, Korea should be more committed to the universal values. At the same time, the new administration will make efforts to harmonize our national interests with the interest of human beings. And also, he stressed the need to open the era of peaceful Korean Peninsula that is free from nuclear weapons. At the same time, North Korea will be on a path to development by dismantling its nuclear programs. The new administration also will actively pursue Asia policy toward South Korean U.S. alliance. He stressed the need to renew our mutual values and peace. I think that the president-elect after election only refers to the United States, the only country with which he would like to strengthen ties. So we have to wait until the creation of presidential transition team. We'll have some important people in the next estimate, and then we'll have a whole clear picture. But this is what I get from my government relating to the statement made by the president-elect. I made this comment to help understand the possible future orientation of foreign policy goals of new administration. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I was struck by something that the president-elect said in his comments just a few hours ago. He said, for North Korea, he said it was very important for North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons and that doing so would ensure its development. This brought to mind a conversation that I recall having 5 years ago with President-elect Ngo. Just a few hours after he was elected, we went to see him and sat down with him, and we asked him about North Korea. And he said something that really struck me. He said, North Korea has to choose between its survival and nuclear weapons. This is actually a milder version of that, but it's rather interesting, the similarity of views between the two. Why don't we go on to the next question? Right there.
Muir Murphy from Kyodo News. Dr. Siegel, you said that North Korea should take its relations with Japan seriously, and
South Korea.
Well, it'll be nice for the North
both.
To do that
I
as
said
well.
Both. I said South Korea, but both is correct. Yes.
Do you get the impression that North Korea is taking its DPRK U.S. relations something more important than its relations with Japan, and what both Japan and North Korea need to do for better atmosphere in the talks. Thank you.
I think there's no question that North Korea's first priority has been the relationship with the United States. But that's only first priority. I think if you look at the pattern here, which goes back to the late 1980s, the North Koreans need reconciliation with South Korea, the United States, and Japan. And it's only under those circumstances then that they would consider giving up their nuclear weapons. It's only under those circumstances. And therefore, the relationship that has been lagging at this point has been the Japan relationship. And that primarily was Abe didn't want to move the relationship. Abe's gone. Fukuda wants to move the relationship. Yes, he has a right wing to contend with within the LDP, but he also, more importantly, has an opposition party that could actually beat him in the elections. And Ozawa wants to move ahead with relations with both North and South Korea, not just with China. And so we are at a moment where I think the North Koreans understand they've got somebody they can do business with. What they're worried about is, you know, obviously what everybody doesn't know, which is, will the current government survive, and if so, for how long? But I think you will see there are all kinds of signs on both sides in terms of what Fukuda's been saying, in terms of what the North Koreans have been doing, though not always saying, that suggests some things are moving forward. I don't think they've moved very far since Fukuda took over, but they're starting to move. And my hunch is the first clear sign is you'll have a change in rhetoric from the North. So far, the rhetoric's been pretty tough, so I don't think the North Koreans are quite satisfied with how far the Japanese have come. The heart of this is the Pyongyang Declaration. And there are a whole set of reciprocal undertakings in that Pyongyang Declaration that have to be moved step by step. It's a bilateral problem. Nobody can help the Japanese, and nobody can push the North Koreans. They're going to have to work it bilaterally. But I do think there's an opportunity here.
Just a few months ago in this very room, a very senior North Korean official in this conversation with Madeleine Albright and Henry Kissinger and others said something that I found rather remarkable on this subject. He was asked about North Korea's attitude towards Japan. And he said, Japan is a country that is very close to us in terms of distance. And someday we hope to make Japan a country that can be close to us in our hearts as well as in its geography. It's a rather interesting comment coming from a country that has a hostile relationship to Japan. We had a question right here, right in the front, and then we'll go to the next one there.
My name is Tae Kang. In Korean language, should be Tae Kang, but I changed my name. Simplified. Simple is beautiful. And this is New York. And first of all, thank you for Mr. Siegel for your splendid, outstanding contribution for our magazine, which is News of Korea. And you got the check, right? And we, it seems that we have one moderator and two moderates and one hardliner in the panelist, and also one government spokesperson sitting in this section. Now, the other remaining group are journalists and other guests. Well, this question goes to Mr. Siegel, director of the Northeast Asia Cooperative Security Project at the Social Science Research Council in New York. Very long name. Well, you said that after the election of Lee Myung-bak in South Korean election, The conservative camp, as well as the government, the new government, is going to have a rather you know, severe, correct me if I'm wrong, severe ideological conflict or fight, not only in the National Assembly, but also in the general mood as well. Maybe that's because, you know, the president-elect has to accommodate or at least show gratitude to the supporters in the right-wing section. Well, my question is, but personally, I don't think, you know, there would be such a, I mean, ideology or ideological strife or conflict would be the dominating issue for the Korean audience or general public also. I mean, this election was, the main focus was it's the economy stupid sort of thing. And then people chose him as president because they, you know, regarded his merit as a head of the corporation, successful, as well as head of the city, big city, right? And then, so they thought that this guy is the man who can lead us into the economic jungle of the 21st century. Now,
what's the question?
Yeah,
my question. I'm sorry. My question is actually, you know, I don't expect such a strong ideological strife going to go on in South Korea. But you still prefer to think, you know, there would be some sort of ideological shift as well.
No,
I mean,
actually, unless I might have been, you know, not made myself clear. There are ideologues around the president-elect who will want to push him off a pragmatic track, okay? And that's clear. And so within the administration, there will be a little tug of war. Do I expect the ideologues to prevail? Actually, no, I don't. But I do think there'll be a tug. Most of the Korean voters who were ideologues didn't vote for Kim Young-bak, they voted for Lee Wei-chung. Okay? But within the inner circle of policymakers, there are clearly people, I mean, I know people I've talked to who are close to him, who still have a rather different view, and I think that'll have to get sorted out. I expect it to be sorted out in a pragmatic direction, but one should not dismiss that there are ideologues around Lee Myung-bak. 15% is not minimum. 15% was, you know, a quarter of the center-right vote. I mean, it's not trivial. And if you look at the National Assembly, I think you know, you can count heads as well as I, there are a number of ideologues in the GNP who weren't particularly happy with the new policy positions announced by Lee Myung-bak and Park Geun-hye. But I think they are a minority, and they will make noise, they will push back, but I'm not sure they'll win. That's all I would say.
Please keep your questions short. We do want to get all the questions in before we break up today. Right over here.
Okay, Martin Wang from China's Xinhua News Agency. My question is for Mr. Zagoria. Sir, you just said that after the denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula, the six-party talk mechanism will become a regional security framework. My question is, how will it function after the nuclear issue is solved? What the framework will be like? Thank you.
Well, hopefully the Northeast Asia will model itself on what happened in Europe in the 1970s after centuries of hostility between England, France, Germany. The Europeans came to an association, the European Union, that was based on the idea that they had more a greater stake in cooperation than in conflict. They have developed made remarkable progress in the past half century or so in that direction. In Northeast Asia, what we see is a situation that many people have compared to Europe pre-1914. Territorial issues, historical issues, we've already mentioned the Korean attitude towards Japanese towards Koreans. So there's a lot of potential conflict under the surface in Northeast Asia. And one of the urgent requirements over the next several decades is to bring all the countries in a region together and to try to figure out what the mathematicians call a win-win situation, a positive sum rather than a zero-sum competition. And the best way to do that is through economics, trade, prosperity. I'm stunned by what's South Korea's per capita income now, 20,000, 30,000?
18,000.
Yes. I first went to South Korea in 1963. When what was their per capita income? $4,000.
Oh, less than that.
Less.
Under a thousand. Okay, so here we are, a few decades later, and it's gone from under a thousand to what? What'd you tell me? 30,000. 19,000. 20 times. 20 times. You have a South Korean middle class. You have a businessman, president. Under those circumstances, it's a lot easier for countries to cooperate with each other. When the economic underpinnings are there. That's what's happening in China. That's what happened in Japan. It's now happening in South Korea and Taiwan. And so we're going to have to figure out a security system to reflect this extraordinary economic progress. And I hope to see the day when I don't have to hear Koreans and Japanese debating history issues. Rather, I look forward to the day when they can talk about the future rather than about history.
It'll be ecology, which may be even more difficult than history.
Not to interject a note of too much skepticism here, but obviously before the six-party talks can be turned into a regional security dialogue, they've got to solve the issue that the six-party talks were set up to solve, which is the North Korea nuclear issue, and we're not quite there yet.
Right.
We've got some homework to do before we get
Evans,
there.
Evans, I would say slightly differently. We have to start the regional security dialogue in order to solve the nuclear issue.
That's a good point.
If we do that, however, you will have now, despite all the skepticism, in fact, be talking about the most fundamental security issue currently facing the region and resolving it. So this is a real security dialogue here. Yes, a lot of it's bilateral, but within a framework where all six parties are interacting with one another. That is a very positive thing. If it succeeds, that's a really positive thing.
Right. Good point. Right in the middle, right here.
Good morning. John Boyle, a recently renewed member of the Korea Society.
Welcome back.
Thank you. I was just wondering if I'm recalling the details of Lee Myon-bak's platform was that he was going to build a 20-mile waterway somewhere in Korea to stimulate the economy. And I'm just curious, could this possibly be an overture to Kim Jong-il in terms of, in light of all these favorable circumstances, sort of saying, well, we can do this Three Gorges Dam type-like project in South Korea now to stimulate our economy. Well, now with the Kaesong, you seem to like the Kaesong situation. Kim Jong-il. Is it possible that we can do something like this in North Korea, some major project? And so he's sort of, this is a carrot that they can eat. Yeah. I don't know if anybody has any ideas on that or has thought about that. So that's my question. Thank you.
Actually, the president-elect, as part of his campaign presentation in North Korea, addressed the idea of doing major projects in North Korea. I don't think he specified in any detail what they were, but he also talked about developing several free trade zones in the North, presumably with considerable support from the South. So I think the idea is out there that this new government, this new president, is prepared to do some things. And, of course, one of the centerpieces of his presentation on the campaign trail regarding North Korea was lifting up North Korea's income levels to, I believe it was $3,000 U.S. dollars in the coming years. And that's a tremendous carrot to be dangling out there for the North. So I think the answer to your question is that this seems to be a president-elect and a new administration that will be coming on board in a few weeks' time that will be prepared to do this sort of thing, provided that the North delivers on its commitments on the nuclear side.
To me, the most natural thing to build on would be the reconnecting of the railroads. That is a huge project because the gauge is different, but the benefits of it would be tremendous. When I was ambassador, I used to have toasts at dinners of Busan to Paris because it used to be possible to get on a train in Busan and you'd arrive 2 weeks later, rather bedraggled in Paris, but you could do it, and that is something that would have immediate benefit to the North, and I hope that he will consider that as well as this canal, which I'm not really sure is going to fly.
Do canals fly? Anyway, we have time for one more question. Why don't we just go right here, and then let's end it.
Thanks. My name is Wen Chen. I'm with Beijing Review. I have a question for Mr. Zagoria. You mentioned that the election of Mr. Lee will very likely strengthen the U.S.-ROK alliance. So it's also beneficial for the Bush administration to engage while balancing China in that region. So how about the relations between China and ROK? Can you talk a bit about Mr. Lee's attitude towards China? Thank you.
There are probably other people on this panel who know Mr. Lee's views better than I do. I can't claim to know them. But it would seem to me that any South Korean president will want to take advantage economically of the rise of China to increase China is already South Korea's what? Its largest trading partner. Students, there's more students now going to China, I understand, from South Korea.
U.S.
But still, U.S. is that, but China's up there.
Mm-hmm. China's been increasing.
Okay. So levels of economic engagement and student contacts are growing, just in terms of a sensible regional strategy, any South Korean president would want to have a good relationship with China. China has been a constructive player in the six-party talks. South Korea will now join that, or has also been a constructive player. And so there will be a cooperative U.S., ROK, Chinese, Japanese, Russian position on North Korea. So there are lots of bases for continued cooperation between the ROK and China. But I don't know enough about Lee Myung-bak's specific attitudes towards China to
No, I think Don has pretty much captured it. Let me just add one other dimension to this, and that is obviously the economy was a tremendous issue in this campaign. And if you look at what the anxiety, what was driving the anxiety in the South in terms of its economic future, one of the obvious issues was competition from China, low wage rates, et cetera, the fact that so many factories, not only from Korea but other places in Asia, have moved their production facilities to China. And this was a growing concern for Korean firms and a lot of the Korean CEOs who have the ear of the president-elect were expressing concerns about Korea's future competitiveness in an era in which you have a very, very dynamic and rising China in every sense, including in the economic sense. So while all of the positive and cooperative aspects of ROK-PRC relations were spelled out very clearly, there's also an element of anxiety that comes with the relationship with China that's driven by this economic concern. We actually do have about 3 or 4 minutes left, and I saw one hand in the back. Go ahead.
Just one thing. I'm not sure economics is the driver for security. I think security is the driver for security. I think it is very interesting that the Chinese showed starting in the 1990s, that they were more interested in the South Korean relationship than the North Korean relationship. They've been careful about that because they understand that if North Korea feels abandoned in any way, shape, or form, they're more likely to want the nuclear weapons. And so nobody's talking about abandonment here. But clearly the relationship that matters more, not just in economic terms, but in security terms, to China, is the South Korean relationship. The reverse is also, in some ways, true. If you, most of you are better informed about Korean history than I am, but I've learned from many Koreans that the history of Korea has not done well simply with an alliance. It needed more than that. It needs cooperation in the region. And so if you look, starting with at least with Noteu in the recent times and going through Kim Dae-jung, all of them wanted to do more than have the alliance with the United States. And I suspect that will also be somewhat of a motivator for the next government in South Korea as well, recognizing that it still wants the alliance. But the question is, what really adds to security is to damp down, is to build cooperation in a larger frame.
I think that's an excellent point. I mean,
that's what you said that too.
Looking at, well, that's why I think it's such a good point. But looking at Korean history, there are others who know more about it in the room than I do, but looking at it, Korean history from a geostrategic point of view, the years 1894, 1905, and 1950 stand out. When Korea became a flashpoint for great power rivalry. And incidentally, that's what we're hearing from the North Koreans as well as the South Koreans. So, and I don't think it's an accident that it was a South Korean president who first came out with the idea of a Northeast Asian security organization many, many years ago. So South Korea needs a regional cooperative structure.
That's probably going to have to be the last word. We've actually reached the witching hour here. I want to thank everybody for coming today. We had a fascinating discussion. We've covered the waterfront of this issue and others that relate to it. There have been a lot of things said today, but perhaps one of the most important ones was the comment about the fact that democracy, a lively, vibrant, contentious, noisy, but incredibly effective democracy has once again been shown to be well entrenched on the southern part of the Korean Peninsula, and that is a fantastic thing. Thank you very much for all of your attention today.
The opinions expressed at this forum do not necessarily reflect those of the Korea Society. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Members of the Korea Society are notified of all Korea Society events, enjoy discounts on admission to programs, and a complimentary subscription to the Korea Society Quarterly. Memberships may be purchased online at our website, www.koreasociety.org.
The proceeding was a production of the Korea Society. For more information on our programs, please visit www.koreasociety.org.